This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour.
And welcome right across Melbourne and Victoria. It's Justin Smith here for Rochelle Hunt. It's good to be here. Thank you very much for having me. Coming up today, under a new plan from the federal government, streaming services like Netflix, I guess is the most famous of them, will be required to make Australian content. Now, the deal's not done yet. This is just a plan. It's yet to become law, but it sounds big. But there may be some issues here for Australian writers, Australian actors and Australian crews, because it may not be, as good as it sounds, it may not quite be everything that it is cracked up to be. But we'll have a look at that coming up. But while we're at it and while we're chatting about Australian content, we have such an enormous history here of Australian-made shows. This will get your blood flowing, like this one. Yes, and then you've got this one.
He used to give me roses.
Oh, the bars close. Yes, clanking.
I think as we
were rifling through these this morning, I think this one would have to be my favourite Australian TV theme ever. Oh, so good. Cop Shop was that one, just in case you were wondering, and I'm sure you guessed it on your own. But so I want to ask you this question: 1-300-222-774. You know the number, 1-300-222-774. What is your favourite Australian TV show of all time? What did you enjoy? I won't spit out any names. I'll give you my favourite a little bit later on. But what was your favourite? 1-300-222-774. And also, coming up on Tuesday, it will be the 11th of the 11th. Not only Remembrance Day, but it'll be 50 years since the dismissal in 1975, when our heads were full of things like blocking supply and names like Junie Morosi and Kim Larney and Jim Cairns and the Loans Affair. And when we also found out that the Governor General could do something that we could never have thought that he could have done. And we were shocked by it, but it wasn't just the public that was shocked by what happened. In the days before the sacking, Gough Whitlam was being interviewed by the ABC, and he said this.
So must Sir John Kerr accept your advice, whatever advice you give?
Unquestionably, the Governor-General takes the advice from his Prime Minister and from no one else.
And must act on that advice?
Unquestionably, the Governor-General must act on the advice of his Prime Minister.
There is no tolerance here. He must
none
do.
None whatever.
None whatever were the words of Gough Whitlam in the days before. And then on the 11th of the 11th, in front of the old Parliament House, which was then just the Parliament House, Gough Whitlam then said this.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen. Because nothing will save the Governor-General.
Enormous moment, huge, the biggest political moment in Australian history before and since the dismissal. And while that was unfolding in the cool of Ballarat, a scruffy young bloke was watching it unfold with rage. It pushed him to join the Australian Labor Party, which he then went on to lead in Victoria and became the Premier of the state. That scruffy young 19-year-old's name is Steve Brax. We're going to have a talk to him very soon about some memories of the dismissal. But what do you remember about it, and what was unfolding, and what did it change for you? It changed the life of Steve Brax, but what did it change for you?
ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
And it's Justin Smith filling in for Rochelle Hunt, and thrilled to do so. The Victorians of the Year have been named. Carrie Bickmore has been named the Victorian of the Year for her work in raising money for research into brain cancer, something that took her husband's life in 2010. Abraham Quoll is the Young Victorian of the Year, a community leader and recognised for his money raising for the support of African Australian families. And the Senior Victorian of the Year, Brian Lipman, is in the studio and good enough to join us. He's a person who has dedicated a very large chunk of his life into finding aged care for the homeless. He is the founder of Wintringham, which he did in 1989, an organisation that he led for decades. And perhaps he can be best summed up, Brian Lipman, the Senior Victorian of the Year, can perhaps be best summed up by something that somebody once said about him. They said, he thinks of everyone else except himself. Brian Lipman, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Pleasure.
How are you feeling?
A bit tired, a bit confused, excited, a lot of emotions.
When did you find out? When did they tell you?
I was at a function last night at the Arts Centre. It would have been, I suppose, 9 o'clock, something like that.
So there's no early warning? There's no, hey, Brian, you know, you're going to get the big one here. It just happens.
The early warning was my wife telling me I was going to get it.
Ever the optimist.
Yeah, that's right.
I want to ask you about the award coming up, and I want to ask about you. But first of all, you've spent so much time working with people in aged care. When you decided to move into this area, what was it? What pushed you into it?
I was working in a homeless person's night shelter called Gordon House, which in those days, this is the largest night shelter for homeless people in Australia. It was in the 80s. In that building were 300 people, frail, elderly, young, violent, every walk of life, but they were all homeless. They'd all suffered in some way. It was only when my parents got frail and elderly, I had to get them aged care, I suddenly realised, well, why aren't my guys at the night shelter getting it? And then as I started to wander around and try to go to other aged care providers to get my guys accepted, none of them would accept it. So then started, a profound sense of anger that we were allowing organisations to discriminate on the basis of poverty. So I then went home and I said to my wife, I want to quit my job and set up a new welfare organisation. And the dear woman said, okay. And I did. And the first 2 years I was the only employee. I didn't have much of a clue about what I was doing. Perhaps I still don't. But slowly it's grown, or rapidly it's grown, and now we have over 1,000 staff and we're the largest provider of services to elderly homeless people in Australia.
When was that moment that you thought we're making a difference here?
I think the moment, it's very difficult to answer those questions, but our guys, so many of them are powerless and frightened. I think the moment I remembered was a guy called Colin, who was in a wheelchair, frightened, living in this terrible night shelter where people were bashed and occasionally raped. And as I've said once, there was even a cannibal there. And it was a terrible place. And he was isolated and quiet and lonely. He came to Wintringham and slowly began to realise that this is going to be his new home. He had people caring for him, loving him. Mm. And he said, I'm going to start a garden. And before he knew where he were, in his wheelchair, he'd start a little garden at his front for the next guy. But he survived. And he lived there for quite a few years. And the garden prospered. And he prospered. He started to rejoin, talking to people, engaging. We started to learn about his life, his pattern. And we knew nothing about that before. So it was a clear indication to me that you provide security and peace, love, people will blossom.
Aged care is something that only seems to you know, come to the fore once in a while when there's some kind of a scandal, mm. something has happened. The rest of the time it can be all too easily forgotten.
Mm. Yeah, I think there's a lot of unfairness about that. I have nothing but the greatest respect for the carers. They work very difficult jobs, a lot of jobs that most people wouldn't do for very little money. I think it's terribly unfair that they have to be almost ashamed to be workers. Certainly this award will validate to my staff that they're doing great stuff. It's been recognised.
I was watching you give evidence at the Royal Commission in 2019 for aged care, and there is a line that you said that was extraordinary and so simple too, which was that people need to stop looking at the building and look at the care that is going on. Is that a trap that we fell into? Mm. Oh, look at this place. Got a big door at the front, beautiful gate, great garden.
Yeah.
But inside, the care wasn't happening.
Yeah, we were fortunate enough to build buildings that were what I wanted to live in myself. So they were very comfortable. They were beautiful buildings. They won international awards. We'd get a lot of people coming looking at the buildings. And I used to say, stop looking at the buildings, look at the care. You're seeing the most amazing things. Our staff do terrific work, and it's about empowering disadvantaged people. One of the most powerful memories I have of a young worker who was sitting down with a homeless, illiterate client who was dictating to her his complaint against her. And I thought, how wonderful that is, that A, he can make a complaint and know he's not going to get bashed or evicted.
Yes.
And secondly, how good that this young worker knows that she's not going to get victimised by the complaint. And we investigated it, and sure, there was some things we could have done a bit better, but everyone was a winner. And I just happened by sheer luck to be there to witness that, and it was inspiring.
Well, you yourself are a very inspiring person, so I want to get to know you a little bit. 1969... shooting across the Nullarbor on a motorcycle to come to you first stop Victoria, was it? Girlfriend on the back. Set that scene for us, please.
That's what we did. We headed off. We got to Western Australia and eventually got a job on a farm as a jackaroo and did the next 14 years of doing that type of work, including as a shearer and a slaughterman. And eventually we came back to Melbourne and I retrained, became a social worker. The dear girl stayed with me and is now 55 years together.
Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
The girlfriend's the one who predicted that you would win Senior Victorian of the Year.
And she's still my girlfriend.
Well, I've got to, as a motorbike nut, I've got to ask you, what was the bike in 1969?
Oh, mate, you wouldn't have wanted to know. It was a Ural. But I've had lots of other bikes. As someone once said, I've had 20 bikes and only one wife, so that's okay. You keep changing bikes.
Well, I got that wrong. So you didn't come from Western Australia and go that. You went the other way. You went spent those years in Western Australia before you came back here to become a social worker.
And went to other states too. So we travelled all around. We saw a lot of Australia.
Well, I think I was going to ask you who would be most proud of you at this moment.
Oh, Dot.
I think, I think I've already got the answer now. So let's put the girlfriend to one side.
Yeah.
Who would be most proud of you for what you've achieved? Even if they're not with us anymore. Someone who would have been really cheering you on.
I think the comments I get from staff and clients is more than enough.
What do we need to change in aged care? What's the next big thing that we need to get fixed?
Well, I've made a habit over the whole 40 years of not talking about aged care. I talk about homeless people accessing aged care. Mm. I think the aged care sector has enough competent people to advocate for their general clients.
In your area, then, what?
Well, in my area, firstly, we should be very proud that Australia has a system where an organisation like Wintry-M can exist. I have never seen in any other country elderly homeless issues being addressed through aged care. They've always been addressed through housing, through homelessness. So what we've argued is our guys are aged and homeless, not homeless and aged. And it's not semantics, that's a fundamental difference. So I think that's a terribly important distinction.
Brian, it's a real honour to meet you. Congratulations again. Thanks for coming into the studio.
Okay, thank
appreciate
you.
It very much. Brian Lipman is the 2026 Senior Australian of the Year for Victoria. A great honour and an incredible man.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
It's Justin Smith filling in for Rochelle Hunt. Thank you very much for having me. As I mentioned at the start of the program, the year was 1975. It's 50 years ago this Tuesday that we were stunned by the sacking of the Whitlam government. He was sacked by Sir John Kerr. And it is something that happened that beforehand, most of us would not have thought that it was possible that it could have happened. We saw the Whitlam government struggling to fight off scandal with the loans affair, Judy Morosi, Kim Larney, those names were floating around for months. There was scandal, but we never would have thought that it had ended the way it did. But in a town, when that happened in 1975, on the 11th of the 11th, in a town far away from Canberra, a 19-year-old from Ballarat was getting fired up, so fired up that he joined the Australian Labor Party and went on to become the Premier of Victoria. He's on the phone with us right now, Mr. Steve Brax. Thank you for your time.
Good to be with you, Justin.
Mr. Brax, when I talk about those things and we talk about the names like Kim Larney and Judy Morosi and the loans affair, what sweeps back into your mind?
There were a lot of issues. It was a very volatile period, really, the period leading up to the dismissal. And you're right, the loans affair was a big issue. There was economic issues. Unemployment was high. And it all culminated in the Fraser opposition blocking supply in the upper house. That is what's happening in the US currently, where they can't get through a money bill, was happening here in Australia, and effectively it would shut down the whole of government. And it was an extraordinary period, very volatile, very exciting, if you like, in lots of ways. And I was, I've got to correct you here.
No, that's okay.
No, I was actually 21, not 19, believe it or not. Mm. And I joined the Labor Party the year before in 1974. And so I was actually...
Well, there's people running around telling lies about you. They said that you joined in 1975, but that's okay.
Well, they're good lies. I'd prefer to be with
that. Okay. So, you like my version better.
Yeah, that's right. Look, and it's hard to imagine now, but politics was everything at that time. Everyone was tuning in. Everyone was listening to what was happening. And at that time, the parliamentary proceedings were broadcast on what was then 774. They were broadcast live because parliamentary broadcasts had just started in 75 and as an experiment, and it was ongoing. And I was at home at my parents' house where I lived in Mount Clear, just outside Ballarat, in my bedroom, listening to the parliamentary proceedings, because I thought there would be a half-cent election. I thought Gough Whitlam would call a half-cent election, and we're all waiting for that as a way of breaking the deadlock of what was happening in the upper house. And I heard on the parliamentary proceedings the Speaker, Gordon Scholes, calling on the member for Werriwa. And I couldn't believe it. I thought, member for Werriwa? Why isn't he calling on the Prime Minister?
Yeah.
He gave him the call in the house, and then Whitlam got up and indicated that he had been sacked by the Governor-General, and it was just cataclysmic. I could not believe it.
And what did you do? You're angry.
What could you do? So I immediately left home, went to what I thought would be the place that you could go to assemble with others, and that was the Trades Hall Council in Ballarat in Camp Street. So I went to Camp Street and I got there, and there was hundreds of others there, members of the party, supporters of the Whitlam government. They were there as well. And somehow, someone had found a, this is true, by the way, someone had found a coffin or come across a coffin.
Yes.
We draped it in black. We wrote the death of democracy across the coffin, and I was, with others, carrying it on the shoulders from the Trades Hall in Ballarat down to the only place we could think of to protest effectively was the Ballarat Courier office in Sturt Street. So we carried that coffin down and then had roaring speeches on the steps of the Courier office. And so that was my experience of the dismissal.
That's an extraordinary. Do you remember? You obviously remember the events that happened. Do you remember feeling that anger, and that disbelief?
Enormous anger. In fact, death of democracy wasn't just the slogan on the coffin. It was actually what we felt. We felt this was the democratically elected government being sacked by the Queen's representative. It was outrageous, unprecedented, and we never, ever thought this would happen in Australia. And so there was a sense of anger, and immediately we turned to the re-election of the Whitlam government, and immediately went into campaign mode. And enormous, enormous campaign rallies were held. You know, we had one in Ballarat addressed by Bob Hawke, who was then the president of the ACTU. Secretary of the ACTU, and it was thousands of thousands of people in the Civic Hall in Ballarat listening to every word of Bob Hawke in that period. And we thought, you know, there was numerous people coming out on the streets, and we thought this is going to mean that the Whitlam government would be re-elected, that the injustice that was done by sacking Whitlam would be overturned and he would be re-elected. And how wrong we were, of course. You know, the size of the demonstrations didn't resemble anything like what was going to happen at the ballot box soon after, and the Whitlam government lost significantly, one of the worst losses we've had, actually.
Was that a fuel for somebody like you who went on to then achieve, to win a seat and then become a leader? And was that fuel for you, what had happened?
Oh, totally. Enormous fuel for me. I went on to manage our campaigns in the seat of Ballarat, the federal campaigns, which we eventually won with John Milton. We had a breakthrough after 27 years and won the federal seat. I managed our state campaigns, and Frank Sheehan was a breakthrough there where we won the state seat. And then I went on to stand myself when I was a 29-year-old in the seat of Ballarat North, against the sitting member, Tom Evans, who was more than twice my age. I stood in 85, lost. Then I stood twice in 88 in a by-election when he left. I got a good swing to me, and then the general election a bit after that. So I had three goes at getting into state parliament as a result of what was happening in the dismissal. I was so motivated. I wanted to get in. I wanted to do things. I wanted to make a difference.
What do you think we have learned, you know, 50 years later? Is the vapor trail of what happened still there, and are the lessons still being learned, or have we forgotten too much of it?
I think one thing we should learn is to never take our democracy for granted. It should be cherished. We have a great democracy, you know, compulsory voting, the preferential system, you know, it's one of the best in the world, the secret ballot. Don't take that for granted. It's important that we enshrine it, we keep it, and we celebrate it. And I think that's the big lessons coming out of 75. Look what can happen when you don't take it for granted.
Are you shocked that we didn't become a republic after what had happened? I guess there were a lot of things. We were shocked about the sacking. We were shocked that Gough Whitlam wasn't re-elected, or you were shocked that he wasn't re-elected. But we were also shocked that we didn't say, hang on a sec, we can't have this. We've got to change.
Yeah, I was shocked when we didn't become a republic. In fact, fast forward, I was actually the leader of the Labor Party and Premier when the ballot for the Republic was held in 99. And in an ironic move, there was a rally on the steps of Parliament House in support of the Republican vote. And I had on one side of me former Prime Minister Gough Whitlam, on the other side of me former Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser. I held up both their hands because they were both campaigning for the Republic, and I thought we were going to get there. In fact, if you look back now on that referendum, the only state in Australia that had a majority for a Republic was, in fact, Victoria. And my hometown of Ballarat, that Ballarat federal electorate, had an overwhelming majority for Republic. So, yeah, I thought we were going to get there. My own personal experience thought that, and unfortunately not.
It's extraordinary. It says a lot about Australia, the fact that the debate is almost in that coffin that you were carrying to the Ballarat Courier. In 1975, the debate around the Republic has gone. There's probably never going to be a greater champion for the Republic as Prime Minister with Anthony Albanese, yet he has dropped it. He said he has no plans to do it. We have an incredible scandal that's playing out with the former Prince Andrew, yet there is no passion for a Republic. Would you like to see that change?
I would like to see a change. I would like to see a republic. I was a member of the Republican movement here in Australia, and I would still campaign for it again. And yeah, let's look. Its time will come. It's not going to come immediately. I can see that, but there will be a time at some point in the future where there will be a move to a republic, and I think it'll just happen as a matter of course, really, when it does. But also, you know, you're talking about lessons learnt out of the dismissal of the Whitlam government. One of the ones I took to government was in my first term as Premier, I brought in a reform bill of the Legislative Council, the upper house in Victoria. And in that reform, we removed the right of the Legislative Council to block supply and bring down the government. So I learnt firsthand what we should do, and I bought that to book in Victoria.
Before I let you go, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you what do you think the state of the state politics are at the moment?
Look, I think the Allan government's improving and going well. They've got a whole series of infrastructure projects being rolled out very soon. You'll see the Metro Tunnel opening very soon, the Westgate Bridge. We've got the Western Hospital, you know, the biggest hospital project in the Southern Hemisphere, which is being commissioned. And I think that'll give it a good run for the government up to the election. And I think they've got the right policies going forward. I think a year to go, I'd back them in.
I see you. They still email you the talking points, by the look of it.
These are my talking points. I don't need anyone to send me those.
All right. And very last question for you. Please take us back, if you don't mind, very quickly. What would a 21-year-old Steve Brax have been wearing? What would he have looked like? Was he a bit scruffy, or was he the tidy kind of type that we came to know?
Very untidy. I think I had flares on. You know, Staggers denim flares. I had a full beard. I had
a beard.
Oh wow!
Okay.
Oh yeah, I had my hair was big. You know, because I've got thick hair, it was sort of frizzy almost. You know, it was a big hair. I look like I should have looked in the '70s.
It's good talking to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay. No worries.
Appreciate it, Steve Brax. God, I nearly said it then. I nearly said Premier Steve Brax. Former Premier Steve Brax, who was in 1975, 21 years old, listening to the radio, listening to this very station, got fired up about what had happened and went down and protested. What are your memories from 50 years ago? Were you angry? Is it exactly what you wanted? You know, is exactly what should have happened? Have you changed sides? Were you on, say, Gough's side way back when, or Malcolm Fraser's side? And have you changed over the years as you get older?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour.
on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
And we were 50 years since the dismissal. It's also been 50 years since Patti Smith put out her iconic album, Horses. And the anniversary coincides with a new memoir by the artist called Bread of Angels, which I haven't read but looks great. And it did get me thinking, too, about great music memoirs, because there have been some crackers over the years. Dr. Liz Evans, novelist, author and literary critic, has actually written a review of Bread of Angels and has read many a memoir. It's on the phone. Hello, Liz.
Hi, Justin. How are you?
I'm great. I enjoyed reading your review, so I'm now looking forward to reading the book. How good is Bread of Angels?
It's a stunning book. I absolutely loved it. It's her most intimate memoir to date, I would say. She's just on a kind of soul-searching mission. It's, you know, the way she reads the world through symbols and synchronicity. It's all in there, as well as the kind of story of her life. Yes, it's a beautiful, beautiful book.
How important in our lives is the music memoir?
Well, I guess it depends how much you love music. I mean, for me, as a former music journalist, it kind of works on all levels. It combines my love of reading, my love of writing, with my love of music. And I think most of us have, you know, favourite bands that we like to listen to, and the people behind the music become intriguing. Good music is often made by very interesting characters. Whether they can write or not, though, is another question.
Yeah, that is a different thing. I think the last one that I read was Keith Richards and Life, which was good because it seemed to be quite quite straightforward and quite honest. I guess we're looking for some honesty there, aren't we? Because there's always the tales of the sex and the drugs and the rock and roll that we want to hear about, but we also want to find out what drives an artist too, don't we?
I think so, and I think that is a good point to make. Keith Richards, I believe, had a ghostwriter for that book. So I would imagine that would have been the skill of the interview process.
Wasn't a young Mr. Jagger, was it, by any chance, that did the ghost? I
don't know. But yeah, I think it is really a good memoir has got to be about more than, you know, the gossip and the sex and drugs and rock and roll, because everybody knows those stories. I think what you want in a good memoir is something you don't get in a standard interview with a band. You want to get a bit deeper and a bit more personal.
And do you think that they, I guess many of them would have felt that, particularly if they were a household name, like a Keith Richards, for example, that had really hit the heights, they'd probably be a little bit sick of hearing untruths about themselves.
Definitely,
And would want to set the record straight as well.
Yeah, I mean, I actually interviewed Marianne Faithfull for my first book, which came out in 1994 in the UK, and it was a collection of interviews with women in music, and I spent many hours with most of the women I spoke to. And Marianne had, as you probably know, been subjected to all kinds of ridiculous rumours and just didn't even want to engage with those stories because they were so preposterous. Yeah.
Yeah, extraordinary. Music, it's such a huge part of our life, isn't it, music? I mean, I would imagine someone like you couldn't even think about what their life would be like without it.
Well, because I spent 10 years listening to music, I had a spell of really needing silence, actually. I felt overexposed to music. And this is a point that another journalist who's written a brilliant memoir called Maybe I'm Amazed, he makes the same point in his book, actually. You kind of get to the point where you've just heard so much, you just either need a bit of silence or you need something completely different. And often it's because of the memories that the music can stir up for you. I think that can be very powerful. And you kind of need a break from that if it's been your work. But now, yeah, I definitely always have music on when I'm driving. I've got to compete with my kids in the house nowadays. But yeah, I can't imagine a life without music. It just would be awful.
Yeah, and just the highlight of Patti Smith's book, what's the central thing, before I let you go, the central thing, because you wrote such a beautiful review, I suggest people look for it. It's in the conversation. Have a look at it. But what is it that struck you most about Patti Smith?
I think she is just such an extraordinary person, and that really comes through in her writing. She doesn't navigate the world like most of us. She lives in this sort of liminal state, and she manages to weave all of that into her writing. She is first and foremost a writer. She was a writer and a poet before she was a musician. So you get this very extraordinary glimpse into the mind of a true artist. And to many people, she's something of a visionary, actually, Patti Smith. She's sort of transcendent in lots of ways, I think. But you also get some factual details that she hasn't written about before, because it took her 10 years to write this book. And she was going through quite a lot of personal discoveries while she was writing it. So she had to put it on hold for a couple of years just to process those experiences. And that, yeah, that's all part of this book. So you feel close to her, but at the same time, what she also does, she manages to retain an air of mystery somehow. It's sort of magic, really.
It's wonderful talking to you, Liz. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Justin.
Dr. Liz Evans, novelist, author, and literary critic. Just Google Liz's name, or you can even Google Patti Smith if you like, and the words "The Conversation," and you will find that review. It's beautifully written by Liz, but it also will, even if you're not a Patti Smith fan, will probably make you want to go and grab the book.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
And it's Justin Smith sitting in for Rochelle Hunt. She's just got the day off. She'll be back on Monday. Fear not, you won't be stuck with me. 1-300-222-774. Is the phone number. And I was asking you, on Tuesday will be Remembrance Day, but will also be the 50th anniversary of the sacking of the Whitlam government. I don't remember a great deal about it. I was 7 years old at the time. There's sort of some faint memories in the vapor trail of what had happened, but I certainly don't remember the moment. But if you do, what do you remember feeling? 1-300-222-774. What side were you on? Who were you supporting? And I think more to the point, did that change as the years went on? Did you change sides? 1-300-222-774. It was great to talk to former Premier Steve Brax, who said that he was 21 years old at the time, in his bedroom, listening to 774, heard what had happened, went down and started protesting. He was he'd been one year as a member of the Labor Party. And then we know where he went to from there. Diane's in Foster. Hi, Diane.
Hi, how are you going?
Wonderful. Thanks for calling in. What did you want to say?
I was travelling in South America and I was about 21, same age as Steve Brack was, and I'd been a great supporter of the Labor government that had been elected in 72. And I was travelling in Argentina and somebody said to me once, "Oh, you're from Australia?" And I said, "Yes." And they said, "Oh, there's been a coup." And I thought, no, you must be talking about the wrong country.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm from Australia. And they said, no, definitely been a coup. So I went to the Australian embassy in Buenos Aires and I said, what's happened? And they were sort of out of control in there. They couldn't even talk to me. They said, here's some press clippings you can read, some news clippings that they had. So I was reading that and it was going, oh, the Prime Minister Gough Whitlam, the Prime Minister Gough Whitlam. And then the next day it's like the Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser. And I just think, how did that actually happen? I could not work out how it happened. I couldn't talk to anybody there because they were in a panic, I think, and in shock. So that's how I found out about it. And I was really upset that I wasn't able to be in Australia to go to some of the demonstrations and things, because I would have for sure. I would have fought it
as much as I could. What a hell of a story. That moment must stay with you forever when somebody said, you've had a coup in your own country. Did you ever change your mind, Diane? Because a lot of people who supported Whitlam could not see, and I'm trying to word this, and I'm not trying to show any political bias here, some people who supported Whitlam couldn't see any fault on his side. They only saw fault on the Fraser side. So did he deserve some of that blame? Was he a little too arrogant in some points of that?
Personally, I don't think so. I think that they brought Australia into the modern world, and there was a lot of changes that were happening. They went very quickly, and I think that there was maybe some communication issues that weren't done, some things that weren't done as well as they could have. But, you know, they thought, I guess, we've got a time that we can make a change, so let's do it. And I haven't changed my views. I've become more left-wing. And I would like to see the Albanese government actually be more bold.
It's good talking to you, Diane. That's a great story. I love that. Thank you very much. 1-300-222-774. We'll have more time for your calls before midday. Your memories of the dismissal, because it'll be the 50th anniversary coming up on Tuesday. Also, your favourite Australian television show, because we mentioned that because there's somewhat of a win which hasn't quite happened yet. It's not into law, but the plan is that streaming services will need to have more Australian content. The Netflixes of this world, the Amazon Primes of this world will need to put more money into making Australian programs. But is that's the plan, and it sounds great, but is that everything it's cracked up to be? Peter Mattesi is the president of the Australian Writers Guild and co-creator of Return to Paradise as well. He's on the phone. Hello, Peter.
Good morning. How are you?
Peter, in the broad strokes, that's the plan, isn't it?
In the broad strokes, that's the plan. This is something that has been in the works for a while. It was an election commitment by the Albanese government from the first term. It's just taken a while to get through. And it's also something that has existed in the Australian television and radio landscape even for 60, 70 years. We've always believed that Australian broadcasters, this is back to radio drama, should be investing in Australian programs just as much as international programs. Right, so it's something that's always been there.
But there is a fear here, isn't there, that what could look good on paper and what sounds like a great plan won't necessarily mean more work for crews and writers and actors necessarily, well, will it? There's a little bit of a question mark over it, isn't there?
There's things to pay attention to. So the model that has been proposed in the legislation is a sort of a choice of models. It's either a percentage, I don't want to get too much into the weeds about this, but it's either roughly a percentage of how much money you take from Australian customers or a percentage of how much money you spend in Australia. And there's various ways of calculating that. And our job, that's the Writers Guild and the industry more broadly, is to just make sure that those provisions operate in the spirit of the legislation, which is to require streamers to invest in local content.
All right. Okay. So what do we want to aim for here? For somebody like yourself who's been involved in this for many years, what are you aiming for? What would be a good solution for us?
A good solution for us is I think the simplest solution is if you are a streamer, let's say Netflix, it's always Netflix we talk about because they're the biggest, and you have, let's say, 1 million subscribers in Australia, they have more than that, paying $20 a month. That's $20 million a month. That's $240 million a year. 10% of that, we think, is fair, or percentage of that is reinvested into Australian content. So $24 million they have to spend a year, which could be, you know, four or five TV shows, depending on the budget, three, four TV shows, a couple of movies, that type of thing. That's a significant increase in what they produce at the moment. And it's an investment in not just the industry. Of course, we talk about the industry and all the people who work in it, but it is not like television and film is not like manufacturing cars. It's not just about the industry. A car manufactured in Adelaide is the same as a car manufactured in South Korea. An Australian television show is different to a foreign television show in that it reflects our culture. So it has a social value as well that is vitally important for Australia as a culture and a community.
But could there be a concern that the America, I don't mean to sling off at America, but let's make them, you know, that an American crew will come over with American actors and they'll make the show in Australia, but it's predominantly something that doesn't do what you just said, which is reflect our culture. Could there be a fear that they'll pour the money into things like that rather than another cop shop?
Yeah, that's the fear. But based on the legislation, a qualifying program needs to satisfy what they call the significant Australian content test, which is basically, does it have Australian creatives telling an Australian story? That's a really broad definition of it, but it wouldn't include the example I gave the other day, you know, a big American movie filming in the Gold Coast with all American creatives and Chris Hemsworth in the lead, that wouldn't necessarily qualify. So that means that it's not just Australian productions, it's Australian content and Australian stories that we're aiming for.
Well, that's good news then, isn't it?
Great news.
Yeah.
It's exactly what we want and what we've always required our broadcasters to do. When it was terrestrial broadcasting, they had to do it. And it's just updating that policy and that vision for the new way we watch television, which is through streaming mainly.
Peter, how old are you, if you don't mind?
I'm 46.
What's your favourite Australian TV show?
Oh, I've got to say Return to Paradise, don't I? Coming back for Series 2.
No, you've squibbed it.
No. On the 15th of November.
Sorry, I talked over your plug then. Give it another plug. When's it on?
It's on 15th of November. We're back on Saturday night, 7:30, ABC One, and streaming on iView, of course. But For me, Neighbours is really important to me as a show that gave me my first job, you know, the start of my career in television, but also as something we used to watch as a family every night.
Yeah.
Not necessarily all sitting down to watch it, but it was on. And we'd be watching it, Mum would be cooking dinner and Dad would be there around. And so those stories were really important to us. And the other one that's just probably my favourite ever is Blue Murder. And I don't know if you remember Blue Murder.
I remember Blue Murder.
The story of the New South Wales police corruption
of
Roger Rogerson and Nettie Smith. Just still a phenomenal piece of television. Just so bold and exciting. I rewatch it quite regularly.
It's good,
and it's just magic.
It's good to talk to you, Peter. Congratulations on everything you do and have been doing and will do. Thank you, mate.
Thanks, Justin. Thank you.
Peter Mattesi, who's a president of the Australian Writers Guild, co-creator of, as you heard it, Return to Paradise, which is returning this month. 1-300-222-774. We will have time if you want to slide in your favourite Australian show. I think Cop Shop, for me, is the one. When I think of Australian TV shows, I go to the police drama and I just, for some reason, think of Cop Shop. Susie's in Preston to talk about The Dismissal. Hello, Susie.
Oh, hello, Justin. Thank you, speaker. Justin, I just wanted to say thanks for asking, really, because it's good to be able to talk about perspectives on those important times in history when you're a bit older and you've got that perspective. So I was 22 at the time of The Dismissal, and I was a starting out secondary school teacher. I think I had the view that all political parties were the same until this happened, and then it was kind of life-changing for me because I was so shocked that there was this, you know, that the Governor-General had this power and to do this. Of course, loved the Whitlam government as well, and the way that Gough Whitlam brought us into the 20th century in so many ways. So, look, the event politicised me, and I haven't really changed my political views at all since then. And,
Well, Susie, thank you very much. We appreciate it. Susan, is with us too. Hi, Susan.
Hello, Justin. I'm ringing about The Dismissal as well. I was 20 and I was working as a gardener for Elthamshire, first in the country, and getting a lift home because my motorbike had been borrowed by a housemate.
Yes.
Yes, and we were listening to the car radio of the workmate who was giving me a lift to my turn-off, and we heard it, and both being unionised, we were horrified. And we just said, well, actually, the older man says that that's it. There'll be a civil war.
Mm.
We can't have this. And so I don't think it was that night. It must have been the next night or the following. We went to hear Whitlam at St Kilda Town Hall on the motorbikes and in overalls. And I was one of the few women there. And I tell you what, it was terrifying.
I'm going to ask you this question too that I asked Diane before. Did you feel in any way as the years go on that Whitlam, I'm not going to say to blame, but also had a hand in what had happened, or have you stuck to your guns in supporting him?
Well, I can see there was a lot of things that the other side would have just been totally freaked out about. I can see that, yes, they were moving very fast and upturning things and spending lots of money, and some of it went astray, I'm sure, as always happens when people move too fast. But But no, I still think it was totally wrong. I still think we should be a republic, and haven't really changed my political views at all.
So wonderful to chat to you. 1-300-222-774. Justin Smith filling in for Rochelle Hunt for the Conversation Hour. Louise is in Gisborne. Hello, Louise.
Oh, hi, Justin. I have maintained my rage over the years about the dismissal of the Whitlam government. I think we shall never see the like of a government like this in this country again, or in many countries, because politicians now have to be sanitised and pasteurised, and they can't fold like Whitlam was. He came in with beliefs that changed this nation, a legacy of which we are still reaping the benefits of today, with the healthcare system, education, no-fault divorce, rights for women. He threw at the city, consumer laws. I could go on forever, but what I want to say is thank you, Gough. And I think the fact that it appeared that Dick Malcolm and Gough had mended the rift.
Yes, what I wanted to ask you about that, because that was an extraordinary thing that Louise, thanks very much for the call. That was an extraordinary thing that Whitlam and Fraser became incredibly close friends and fought campaigns together, not for political parties, but over issues. And I think they were beautiful words that he wrote to Malcolm Fraser. Fraser was feeling... was sort of feeling it one day and feeling concerns over what had happened in the past or something. And Whitlam had wrote a note that just said, let your heart not be troubled, comrade, I think is what he wrote. They're just beautiful words, very different time. Rochelle Hunt will be back behind this very microphone in this very studio on Monday. You have a lovely weekend. I'll talk to you soon.